Welcome to Worlds Apart. From the coalition of the willing to launch wars in faraway lands to the coalition of the unwilling to accept that as the rule of contemporary world order, my guest today argues that staying neutral is a far more ethical and peace-friendly position than rushing in or supplying arms. How come? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by John Gong, Professor and Vice President for Research and Strategic Studies at the University of International Business and Economics and China Forum Expert. It's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Be happy here.
Now, you heard my introduction, and I actually borrowed, this nice play of words from your own article in which you called for a coalition of the unwilling, an alliance of nations staying out of the Ukrainian conflict, which I think increasingly looks like an existential struggle between Russia on one side and the West on the other side. Why is being neutral an ethical or moral position? Aren't you supposed to choose between the forces of good and the forces of evil?
Well, first thing I want to say is that today, staying out of the war is not just enough. For example, China has been under tremendous political pressure to do something on this side, on that side. And I think the countries that represent that camp, the neutrality camp, is actually quite large. I mean, that's the world's majority. And typically the majority is pretty silent on this. And I think it's about time that these countries to come up with a joint, same, uniform voice that, we want to stay out of this war, but at the same time, we do want to play an active role in terms of mediating a peaceful solution here. So I think that's what I'm coming from. I think this idea is really being, received quite well. For example, I can quote a statement from the Brazilian president who visited China recently. He proposed this very interesting idea that a group of countries should, join together to come in, to step in and mediate a solution.
Absolutely, and we have a number of initiatives. I mean, we are recording this interview on the eve of a major visit by several African heads of state who also have some ideas on how this conflict could be mediated. I believe that today they are actually in Kiev, so they are trying to reach out to two sides. But I think it's even bigger than the Ukrainian conflict, because it's many, many countries, big and small, suggesting their own rules of the game and ultimately saying no, not only to the conflict, but also to the current rules-based order, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. First, again, back to your question about why being a neutral position is actually not immoral, in my view, right? I argue for that. I think, this has historical precedent. For example, in my article, I quoted the British experience during the, bulk of the 19th century, when the United Kingdom stayed pretty much out of the continental wars and battles in Europe. Nevertheless, the country has did very well. It thrived in its global network of trade and business. And this was a period of time the historians call the splendid isolation, right?
Yeah, but it was a very, very long time ago.
It was a long time ago. And I think that today, in the 21st century, we need to instill a little bit of a moralism argument.
This is actually something very, very interesting, because you often mention moral issues in your articles, and I think one of the things that happened over the last couple of decades is the United States and the West more generally essentially hijacked all morality for themselves. I wonder if what we are witnessing right now, Brazil, China, African countries coming up with their own solutions to the conflict in Europe, is essentially saying, hold on, we also have a stake in defining what's moral and what's immoral.
Right. I mean, the morality argument was, the moralism argument was hijacked to mean that, without supporting Ukraine, it's immoral. I don't buy this argument at all. I think, we need to be on the side of peace for the first part. With the current stalemate going on in Ukraine, I think, it's not a good idea to keep shipping arms into the battlefields. I think the right thing to do is to advocate for a truce. So you know, it's this is what I'm coming from. But in addition to this, also I think even the idea of imposing sanctions, and I'm not even sure
on the rest of the world,
right? So I'm unabashedly coming out to say that not imposing sanctions doesn't mean that you're not on the side of moralism. I think, you know, sanctions are like weapons of mass destruction. It was demonstrated in the past that it does kill people. It kills more people on the battlefields, actually. And in this case, I think potentially, you know, the casualties may be more than just people in Russia or Ukraine, maybe people in North Africa, in the Middle East, who are suffering from starvation, for example. So anyway, I think, you know, I'm not bashful to say that moralism is an idea that's not just subject to the definition by the West.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and when we say moralism, just because of this ism at the end, it sounds like an ideology, but we are all entitled to our own moral law, to our own morality. And, you know, nobody says that it's only like a group of predominantly white countries that knows what's best for the rest of us.
I totally agree. Now, back to the question about the larger order you're talking about, the rules-based order. You know, the West likes to talk about the rules-based order, but the real question is whose rules, right?
And whether they are upheld by the West itself.
And also whether these rules are being applied consistently. You know, clearly, I think one of the reasons that the Global South are not very happy with rules-based order is that these rules haven't been applied sort of in a uniform fashion. You know, they're clearly signs of hypocrisy, double standards, for example. You know, you compare what's going on in Ukraine versus what's going on in, you know, used to be in Iraq, in Afghanistan, right? You know, totally double standards in my view.
Now, can I bring you to the issue of China's neutrality, because the Americans are pretty open about the fact that in their attempt to preserve their hegemony, first they need to do away with Russia, to undermine Russia, or perhaps to, you know, split it into parts. And then they are also very public, like look at their documents. They say that after Russia question is done, they will be dealing with the so-called China's challenge. How can China be neutral to something like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, a couple of people in Washington as well as in Brussels have come out to say that, you know, America's existential challenge or even threat is actually not Russia, it's actually from China.
No, so your entire existence is a challenge to them. This is how they define this world.
This is how they define it. I mean, the China is a problem because one of two things. One is it's growing too fast. Second is growing too big. So that's in itself becomes a challenge to them. I mean, that's their thinking. But I think you know, the issue is about China's neutrality. I mean, what is this, you know, neutrality? What does it mean, right? I think on the one side, you know, we understand the complex reasons leading up to this conflict in Ukraine. On the other hand, China also has stated very clearly that we should respect sovereignty and territorial integrity. And in addition to this, you know, China's position is that, you know, that should be a truce. I think China's advocacy for truce is really genuine. I think it's not in China's interest. And as people are saying that, well, you know, China's benefited from this ongoing war in Ukraine. That's not true. I don't think that's true. I think China does benefit from a ceasefire, at least. So you know, the advocacy for ceasefire is really genuine, in my view.
Going back to the issue of China's motivation or China's interest, there is a broad consensus here in Russia that Washington chose to make the Ukraine crisis a means, a tool of its, you know, geopolitical struggle for its dissolving hegemony. If that strategy doesn't succeed, don't you think that the Americans will have to come up with something new and perhaps controlling China more directly?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of voices in Washington these days, you know, talking about a political solution in Ukraine. And so that it can, you know, get more resource into the Indo-Pacific. You know, really, they're talking about China. From China's perspective, it's all the same. You know, I think that you know, we are the Chinese side is dedicated to a, you know, trying to get a peaceful solution in Ukraine, as well as you know, not maintaining good relationship with the West as well, with the European Union, with the United States. But unfortunately, you know, the United States has this mentality of. You know, it's you know, he sees China as a big challenge, wants to have a competition, strategic competition with China.
But right? Is it really about competition? I mean, the Americans like to mention this 3C
right.
policy, competition, confrontation, and
cooperation.
Cooperation. Right. Which C do you think is the most visible for the time being?
I think definitely competition is more. I mean,
competition, not confrontation.
Quote competition. Confrontation. I think it's
proxy more, confrontation. Is competition a proxy confrontation?
Well, I think there's sometimes it's even you know very blurred boundaries between confrontation and competition. From China's side, we Chinese probably views this more as confrontation. But I think you know in my view, confrontation really is about only one issue. About Taiwan, you know, that this is one area that clearly Beijing confronts Washington on this. This concerns China's core interests. There's no way we can back off. So, you know, that's more of a confrontational issue.
But
here.
Professor Gong, we have to look at the core motivation of adversaries. I mean, that this is something that the Chinese war strategists did throughout centuries. Do you think the Americans truly care primarily about Taiwan and its freedom, whatever its governance? Or the core issue here is China and its rise, illegitimate rise
of
in their view.
Of course, I mean, Taiwan, you know, is a small island, you know, thousands of miles away. American people don't even, can't even find an island on a map, right? So, you know, this is really one of the issues that it can use by Washington to contain China to in its geopolitical.
To contain or to undermine?
I think you know, the distinction between containment and undermining is it's a semantic issue in my view. I mean, there are things
just
that
like competition and confrontation. Again.
Yeah, I think there are things that certain organizations in Washington, right? I mean, people in the intelligence community, you know, CIA, they do things to undermine other countries. But you know, I think it, you know, in the grand scheme of things, America's interest is essentially to keep China down. Okay, it cannot tolerate a China.
How deep down?
You know, there's some rule about say less than 2/3 of U.S. size, right? You know, does not challenge America's supremacy on the sea, for example, in overseas operations, things like that. You know,
so this is essentially remain a big factory without any voice, without any ambition or aspiration of its own, or
limited,
without any dignity or manifest destiny.
Limited say, limited power, limited influence. I think that's what.
So
Washington
not
is.
Really a country, right?
That I don't think Washington can even dream of achieving. There's no way they can do that.
No, so I understand that, but you are, you know, you worked in the United States for a pretty long time, and I'm interested in the ultimate strategy. What do you think is their preferred goal that they are trying to pursue? What kind of China? Again, I asked you before and I reiterate, what kind of China would suit them? Is it a China that has no voice, a China that has no ambition, and a China that essentially serves as an industrial park for the United States?
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, you know, quite a few years ago, the time when China was accessed to the WTO, there was the expectation that China would develop according to a trajectory that Washington desires of. That certainly didn't happen, right? I mean, I think that represents the sort of arrogant and hubristic opinion on their side that there's only one good model of development, that's the only good model of development. China doesn't go into that direction, so they are disappointed. Now, back to the old question about, you know, the distinction between limited or no voice, I think, you know, from their perspective, probably they're still, and I don't think they expect China has no voice. I mean, come on, this is impossible. I think that what they are desiring is that China has contained, establishing some kind of the analogy of a NATO alliance in the Indo-Pacific region, specifically targeting China. To see China has limited influence, to see China has limited say on international stage, I think this is probably more realistically they are looking for. Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with John Gong, Professor and Vice President for Research and Strategic Studies at the University of International Business and Economics and China Forum expert. Professor Gong, before the break, we were talking about the American preferred vision of China, which China doesn't really want for itself. And you mentioned before that any attempts by China to build independent relationship with other countries is viewed as something negative. For example, your neutrality stance on the Ukrainian conflict is interpreted as a siding with Russia. And I've heard one very interesting Russian expert suggest that the best way to describe a Russian-Chinese relationship would be not win-win, but actually not lose, because each country pursues its own policy, its own economic goals, but they have a key interest in not seeing the other fail, especially as the Washington tries to undermine both of them. Do you agree with such
formulation? That I totally agree. I think this is a very accurate statement.
Now, do you think other countries may adopt that as well? Because it's no secret that Russia and China have many controversial issues. We had plenty of border disputes between us 30 years ago. Most of them are settled for now.
Yeah.
But clearly, on many issues, we have not overlapping position. And yet, I think both sides find value in the relationship as such. Do you think such model could be applied more broadly, not only between the two countries, but perhaps more broadly internationally?
Absolutely. I think look at China's neighbors, and the idea you've been talking about can apply everywhere. You know, in China's relationship with India, with South Korea, with Japan. You know, we all have issues that of conflict interest, but you know, there are also other things in cooperative nature that way more outweigh the little things that we are in, conflict of interest.
You're leading me very handsomely to my next question, because one other country that claims neutrality, a big player on the international stage, is India. And India's neutrality is clearly very different from China's neutrality. What's the biggest distinguisher there?
I think overall, I don't view them drastically different, but I think probably the larger, a big difference is that India's relationship with the United States, right? I think that's in one area. If you look at Washington's action, China and India both adopted more or less same neutrality position. Both have bought tons of oil from Russia, right?
Yeah.
And you look at which country is under more political pressure. It's actually China, not so much India, right? So that says something about Washington's not very consistent position with respect to this issue. So I think if you ask me the big difference between India and China, that's probably the biggest difference. I mean, there's a secondary agenda you alluded to regarding China from Washington's perspective. There's another agenda behind this, right? I don't think that agenda exists with respect to India. And on the contrary, it might be the exact opposite, actually.
Well, the Americans are now pretty open in courting Indians into their various anti-Chinese initiatives. And the American Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, while visiting India recently, promised a whole range of the most advanced military technologies, and sort of inviting India to be this, what did he say, to he complemented India's leading role as a security provider in the Indo-Pacific. And, you know, knowledgeable people can smell anti-Chinese sentiment there.
Exactly.
Do you think the Indians will buy it?
India is a very important piece in America's China policy. Campbell, I think he is responsible for the Indo-Pacific areas. National Security Council, I think. He once famously said that India is a very important component of America's China policy. So, you know, this clearly says that the United States intends to establish the same kind of alliance, you know, like somewhat like the NATO, and drag India in. One thing that's regrettable in my view, that every time Washington goes out to try to court an ally and establish an alliance, what can they offer on the table? Nothing other than weapons, tanks, jet fighters, you know, these things. This is not the way, you know, people from China, we Chinese do things. When we talk about mutual economic business interests, right? Do some business, trade, investment. These are the things that that are conducive to humans' development. I mean, this is called construction. What does weapons and jet fighters do? Destruction, right? So I think that's a key difference I want to emphasize.
You mentioned Kurt Campbell, and just the other day he expressed his hope that the upcoming visit by Indian Prime Minister Modi to Washington would quote-unquote consecrate the relationship with India as the most important for the United States in the world. I suppose ahead of the British and ahead of the Europeans. Again, do you think the Indians will be tempted by something like that? Because they also, all the differences between India and China notwithstanding, India has been a key member of the non-aligned movement before, and I think they're also pretty shrewd in making sure that their neutrality and their own interests are respected.
No, I think I still reserve my intention to say that India it still hasn't bite yet. I think it's, you know, the jury's still out there whether New Delhi will ever get onto the boat of Washington. I give you one specific example. You know, in this area, we have this Quad thing, right? United States, Australia, Japan, and India. I think at one of the meetings recently, India didn't go, you know, when they discussed policies against China and Ukraine, regarding Ukraine. So I think, you know, there might be a difference between India and other Quad members. And also, the United States also has a, I would say, sort of a differential treatment with respect to its allies. They have the first rated ally, for example, UK. In this case, Australia, they're talking about this AUKUS deal, right? They don't include India, they don't include Japan in it. They didn't even, you know, did this on the back of the French's interest.
Mm-hmm. Now, we are all mindful of the difficulties between or differences between India and China, for example, in the Eastern Ladakh region, where you have thousands of soldiers sort of juxtaposed one across another. And for a long time, a conflict like this would be seen as irresolvable. But after China's recent foreign policy successes, for example, with the Saudis and the Iranians, many Russian analysts are asking, if that was possible between Saudi Arabia and Iran, why is that not possible to solve those long-standing difficulties and differences between China and India? Wouldn't that be a great benefit, not only to the region, but to the whole world?
Yeah. I think, you know, the border clashes, you know, the soldiers sort of shuffling each other. They don't fight shots at each other.
There's a few with the casualties. I mean, like, quite a few conflicts.
Right. So, but they've been, you know, exercised force quite in a restrained way, I think. And this is actually quite a few years ago. It's been quite some time since, you know, this peace between the two sides along the border. So I think, you know, both sides realize that it's important not to escalate things, to set aside the differences and, you know, coexist peacefully. After all, we're talking about no man land, actually, in that region. So, you know, this is something that we can talk about or negotiate further along. It doesn't have to be standing in the way of the two countries' relationships. So
over the past year, I think the Chinese foreign policy stance has changed quite visibly. I mean, like, I've been covering foreign policy for quite some time, and it's visible in the statements of foreign policy spokesmen. It's far more outspoken, far more proactive. And I wonder if the calculus of war and peace has also changed. I mean, isn't it now more expensive for the Chinese to have India as an adversary than it was, let's say, 2 years ago?
I think one thing Beijing could clearly recognize is that China is facing a very difficult international environment because Washington has intensified its efforts to essentially establish an alliance. As I said, you know, even establish an alliance somewhat analogous to the NATO in the Indo-Pacific region. So that's a big challenge. And I think China's probably readjust some of its foreign policy stance to, you know, in terms of tactics and policies and measures. I think these days, having one more friend from China's perspective is very important. So I think with respect to India, you know, there are more important things. As I said, we can set aside our differences and, you know, work together, especially to prevent India be a important piece in America's China policy. You know, it's a horrible scenario, I think, from Beijing's perspective, to see India being folded under the Washington's alliance, it's kind of a defense alliance it's trying to establish in this region.
Well, from my conversations with Indian experts, New Delhi is in no rush to be an American proxy, especially given what they saw in the Ukrainian crisis. And this is something that I want to finish on. It's a huge problem for Russia, obviously, not only geopolitical, but also a moral problem, a human problem, because we have many Ukrainians living here. We have, most of us have relatives living there. China has proposed its own peace initiative. And I think China has a sort of different strategy of approaching countries than the United States. Do you think there will ever come a point when the Ukrainians may be sort of responsive to what China has to offer, either on the front of reconstruction or on some other front? Do you think there's a possibility, any possibility, and I'm asking realistically, for the Ukrainians to accept somebody else's help other than the West?
I think, first of all, Kyiv has already responded. President Zelensky has said that he welcomes this plan, and it is elements in this plan that he likes, right? I think, you know, if you're really looking at this plan, it's more of a set of principles, in my view. It's a set of guiding principles under which a negotiation process can meaningfully start. And in a way, I think this is a very typical Chinese way of negotiation. Let's first set aside some standards, some principles as a foundation upon which we can, you know, talk. So I think this is just the first step. In terms of a concrete negotiation, I would imagine that Beijing is willing to take a more active role. But ultimately, I think it's very much up to Washington to endorse the Ukrainian side from starting the process. And I'm being very, you know, upfront and straightforward. Absolutely, you know, Kyiv cannot keep fighting for one day if Washington doesn't want to support it, or at least to support continue fighting.
Well, so, it cannot continue fighting, but it can always, you know, say that we don't want to fight anymore, with or without weapons. Do you think there is enough leverage for China in Kyiv to try to persuade the Ukrainians?
I tend to disagree with the statement. I think, yeah, you know, I think Washington wields tremendous influence on Kyiv. So whether keep fighting or stop fighting, Washington has a big say. I truly believe that Washington has a big say. At this point, I think Washington still wants to fight. But there are, I mean, American policy is always, as these elections going on, and we are starting to see an increasingly large voice from Washington, especially on the GOP side, talking about a peace solution, right? So talking about fighting, an exit strategy.
We have to leave it there. Thank you very much for your time. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.